Hey friends, it is I, Max Casaza, and I got a wonderful podcast for you today with Tejo Munich, a certified Soto Zen priest based out of Alexander, North Carolina. We get into a bunch of topics, including Zen, Buddhist studies, how to meditate, how to sit in lotus position, music. I think you're going to love it. Enjoy. So I was going through your bio on your the Soto Zen Buddhist Association website, and it seems like you're doing a lot right now, because you're developing the Great Tree Zen Women's Temple. And then you're also a teacher at the Zen Center in Asheville, where I think that's where Duncan met you. And then
yeah, he actually did meet me. He came to Zen Center of Asheville. He was at Warren Wilson College, and he came to do an internship for his psychology class, and he was also to Zen, so I just gave him a whole Zen curriculum to do. I think you may have heard, first thing I did was have him clean the meditation hall.
Yeah.
That's what you learn in the monastery, how to clean in Japan. The three aspects of Soto Zen practice are meditation, study, and work. So in any given Soto Zen monastery, at least in Japan, this may not be true in America, there are all of those components are present. So that's what I was trying to create for him, this sort of three-pointed practice. They all kind of go together. And I think he thought maybe he was just going to study. And then I think meditation might have been a little hard for him too at that time. Mm-hmm. But it did contribute a lot to his psychology studies, just studying his own mind. So yeah, that's where I met Duncan. And right now, I'm still in touch with those folks at Zen Center of Asheville, and I give talks there about once a month. But some of the people that practice there, some of the guys, have taken on the teaching roles. So I've given them kind of lay teacher authorization or something. And the same thing happened with the Charlotte group. I actually started with the Charlotte group. I was invited to that group, and then but then I quickly realized that if I was going to move out here, I'd prefer to live in Asheville rather than Charlotte, because I grew up in a big city. I grew up in Minneapolis, which is probably about the size of Charlotte, and so that's how I got associated with them. And in fact, the one person that I've ordained three people, and two of them came from the Charlotte group. So they're still going every Sunday and everything. They meet on Sunday evenings, and the same guy has been leading that group for about 30 years now. So I used to go down there regularly. And then I don't know if it mentioned this on there, but I was going down to Savannah and doing some things down there. Mm-hmm. So people from down there have moved up here too, but yeah, it I get busy at times. COVID was very good because it was a time when I couldn't travel. And it gave me an opportunity to sort of, get some perspective on if you get too much going in your life, then it's hard to prioritize.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're so too busy to prioritize. But when COVID happened and we went into quarantine, we kept all the same programs and we put them on Zoom for Great Tree, which made things pretty quiet around here because there weren't people lingering after meditation and talking. And I'm very social, I'm very extroverted. So it's hard for me not to engage. That's just kind of my personality. But it's also exhausting to do a lot of engaging. So Great Tree, it's unformed in a lot of ways. We did the pre-COVID, and then COVID happened and things kind of shut down and a lot of things went on Zoom. And now I'm trying to figure out what is the most useful way to do a hybrid, really, and also to create a practice here that's really conducive to self-reflection. So
I'm sure it's confusing for some to hear you say that you with your experience and your devotion to Zen and the practice and the studying that you would be extroverted. I think there's an idea that, and of course it's more nuanced than this, but I think for some, like it is a surprise that you still have these other aspects of yourself that that work well with it, even though we're used to thinking of it as a solitary practice.
Well, Zen is really not, Soto Zen is not really solitary practice. In fact, Dogen, who brought Soto Zen from China to Japan in the 13th century, really, really emphasized sitting with other people. I mean, it becomes somewhat solitary because you're sitting quietly, but it's not really. Sitting quietly with other people, I think, is more being present with people than talking. There's more communication, I think, in silence, because we don't have to interpret, and so we're not quite as likely to judge and interpret, and we're seeing someone the way they really are in silence. A lot of body language and a lot of just feeling that you get from being with another person or other people. And Zoom has been difficult in that respect. It's not so good for meditation, although it does give people the opportunity to come together and commit to doing it, so that's helpful. It's like having responsibility to other people as well. But I really, really noticed, and I like Zoom, like I say, it really helped me to kind of pull back a little bit with my extroverted personality, because there was so much going on here for a while that I was just always getting really exhausted. Plus, purchasing the place, we've been here now for 18 years, but the first 10 years we spent just trying to pay the mortgage. And that requires a lot of outreach and just a lot of things like that. And so I was pretty tired from that. And then people coming in and not coming back and just wanting to talk a lot. And it's just really exhausting for someone who has that kind of personality like I have. And I think actually one of the reasons why I've stayed with this, as my teacher told me when I ordained, he told me he wanted me to teach, which I really wasn't thinking about doing, you know. But I realized that it's probably good to have people that are extroverted in at least in the role of teacher, even if I don't, even if I didn't say anything, because it would encourage other people that were extroverted. And we really need that quiet. We really need that meditation time, you know, perhaps more than, I guess everyone needs it in their own way, because it isn't just about being quiet. It's about when we're quiet, looking at the reality of our lives, which is sometimes pleasant and sometimes not pleasant, you know, but to just see clearly what's going on in our lives and come to terms with all the delusions and all of the stories we make up that just really create misunderstandings between people, you know. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think as sharp as a tool language can be, it's really causing us to think in concepts, and instead of being able to, you know, inhabit that pre-linguistic state, which has a little less mobilization of energy, and where you can really be calm. And, you know, I wonder if evolution is working against us in that way, because it's helped us develop these amazing linguistic tools, but it doesn't seem like, sometimes I feel like it doesn't seem our biology wants us to be underneath that state again. It doesn't want us to take that step backward into, you know, what we understood before we began to layer all of these concepts on top of each other.
I think, you know, I mean, it's what Buddha talked about, I think, when he talked about dukkha. Are you familiar with that term?
I've heard it used, but you can remind me.
So dukkha is the first. There's four noble truths.
Mm-hmm.
Dukkha is the first, and it's pointing to the fact that, you know, it's translated as suffering, but that's kind of a misleading translation, I think, for us, because our language is so nuanced. And but what it's really pointing to is that feeling that we as humans, that humans have, that we're not, this is not enough. Always that feeling of insufficiency or anxiousness about, oh, I should be doing something more. I should be something more. And it's a tendency to want to have something to hold on to. And our culture, particularly European culture, well, I guess all cultures probably, but European culture is really, American culture has really taken that to an extreme, in terms of expectations and just communication, and social media has really taken it to an extreme. You know, just always wanting to grasp onto something that appears to be real. And the reason I say social media has taken it to an extreme is because we use social media to do more, to get more done. You know? And the reason that we think we need to get more done is because we think we haven't done enough, or that we're not enough. So, you know, I mean, people get more degrees, they keep going back to school, we keep going back to training, you know, if only I had this. And so that's kind of the way dukkha works in our lives. And language in American, well, not American, it's influenced a lot by Germanic languages, and you know, English is very, especially in this country, is very influenced by the whole European way of thinking, the Western way of thinking. Whereas, you know, like if you go to Japan, they have a very sparse language. Now, they have a whole kind of, I wouldn't call it a hierarchy, but different ways of talking to people that have different positions. For example, it's said, I have heard that very few people can even talk to the emperor because the emperor is a certain language that you use for the emperor. I had difficulty learning Japanese anyway, but speaking to my teacher, I would not speak to my teacher there. I always went through a translator because one time I said something that I would say to anyone, any Japanese person, but he, because he was in the position he was in, I was supposed to be saying it in a different way. But the thing about Japanese that is so really kind of wonderful for me is that most of it is intuitive. They don't use subjects very much. You have to kind of figure it out from the context. They don't have nuanced language like we do. For example, a character, this is Chinese too, a character would have, it might have 10 different meanings in English. And yet, we have to choose one of those meanings when we translate. And so there's always interpretation going on. Whereas if you if you're speaking in Japanese, of course there's interpretation going on, but you're speaking with the person directly and they can figure out what you're trying to say a little bit more from the context. Of course we always go according to our own understanding. So I'm sure that even for people who live in a very intuitive culture, that's difficult. But our culture, you know, our culture is very, very much, language is very much in the culture. It really is an expression of the culture. And our culture is very kind of anal and detail oriented. And I think it makes it a lot harder for us to drop into that place of not knowing and not holding on to something, because our whole culture is telling us there's something to hold on to, there's something to get. And you got to get it or you're not good, you know, or you don't fit in. I don't fit in this culture, except for people who are interested in Zen or Buddhism or some kind of spirituality that helps them to understand. I mean, I'm going in a week, I'm going back to the convent where I used to be. When I was 5, I decided I wanted to be a Catholic nun. And I always wanted to be, well, I wanted to be a priest, but they told me that I couldn't be a priest. So I said, okay, I'll be a nun then. So I went to the convent when I was out of high school, and I left when I was 21. And when I've been back a couple times, and I just went back in 2017, and then I'm going back in about a week. And I feel like there's something that these women understand about me and accept, because their whole life is dedicated to spiritual practice. And even though Catholicism has all kinds of beliefs that I don't particularly agree with, not beliefs, but interpretations, even though I mean, beneath that, there's that spirit of the spiritual quest and constantly going after it. And there was this one nun that was my superior in the convent. She was the first person that ever told me about Zen. She had read an article about Zen. And she didn't just tell me, she told the whole group of us. And I was very impressed by what she said about it. And it's probably the reason why it kind of was on my radar for so many years. But the last time I was back in 2017, she was just turning 89. And she had, when she found out I was a Zen teacher, she wanted to talk to me because she was still doing She was doing meditation every day. She's doing Zazen every day on her own. Nobody else wanted to do it with her. And, you know, there's a different kind of meditation in the Catholic monastic practice, but she was doing Zazen, basically. And she wanted to meditate with me. So when we were talking, I said, well, let's meditate now. And we did for about 15 minutes, but I had to leave because I hadn't anticipated. She says, oh, I wish we could just meditate together for about a week. And so then I made plans to go back, and then COVID happened and I couldn't go back. So this is the first time I'm getting back to meditate with her. And I was really excited because I'm going to be on retreat there and be able. And then last week she died. So I said, well, I guess I'll have to go out to a graveside and meditate with her, you know. But that much, there's that connection. And the Trappists too. Every time I go and visit Gethsemane, do you know Gethsemane? It was where Thomas Merton was, if you've heard of Thomas Merton. Anyway, it's a Trappist monastery. And every time I go there and I'm wearing my Japanese kind of samurai priest clothes, you know, somebody recognizes me and wants to talk about Zen. You know, they've done Zen retreats there. So, you know, I mean, I think there's that capability of that kind of connection among spiritual practitioners. But I don't think that it's present in our larger culture. And it's really hard, even in the bigger Zen world, you know, I find that teachers really get into being popular and doing things that are more interesting. And it's fine, you know, if that's what you need to draw you into spiritual practice. But I think that the thing that's so wonderful about Zazen and the way my teacher taught it was he wouldn't give us any what he called toys, you know. He wouldn't give us any candy, sweet candy, he said, because that's not what's really beneficial in this practice. What's really beneficial is sitting down and shutting up and just seeing what happens. And that's the kind of Soto Zen, that's the kind of practice that Soto Zen does. And that's actually what all meditation practices ultimately point to. But there's, in a lot of meditation practices, they give you stuff to do that sort of makes you feel like you've done something, you know, mantras and koans and things like that. But Soto Zen doesn't, because Dogen Zenji says that's really beside the point. It causes you to always think that the answer is outside of yourself, and it's not. What meditation is just sitting there and seeing how you noticing how your mind works. You know, you just notice it. You don't have to make yourself notice it. You'll say, oh my gosh, man, if you've meditated, you know what I'm talking about. You notice your mind is really busy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people come to me and they say, oh, I think I'm doing it wrong because my mind is so busy. And I said, how many times during the day do you notice how busy your mind is? And they said, well, usually I don't because I'm too busy to notice it. And I said, so I'm like, that's good. That's enlightenment. That's awakening. Noticing how busy your mind is, you know? It's very simple. And then, you know, then your mind gets busy again. You know, but what we do is we try to do something about it, and that makes us busier.
So do you still think there's value in some of these other Zen practices that get you kind of on the path by giving you, in other words, do you think toys help it become more accessible to lay people, or do you think it's just a distraction altogether and you might as well start with nothing at all for any type of person?
Well, I mean, different people are there in different places, you know, in their heads.
Right.
But I think if you're going to do Zen practice, if you're going to do Soto Zen practice, that's just the way it is. And there's lots of other possibilities. Asheville is full of Zen, of Buddhist groups, you know, and some of them are extremely entertaining. And that I don't have any problem with that. That's what that's what certain people need in order to get them into the practice. But if people come to me and say, I want to learn, I just tell them, just come for Sesshin, come for a retreat, just sit down and shut up, you know, because that's really where the value of the practice is. And sitting together, you know, sitting with other people, even if a lot of students that come in on Zoom particularly are in different places. And I say, well, find people to sit with. Don't sit alone too much. Otherwise, we're just kind of seeing everything from our own perspective. Even in silence, when we sit with other people, other perspectives come in. They bleed through our skulls. You know?
They do. They sure do. I've felt that my studying of music has been, you know, a spiritual endeavor, and that for me to really see what the practice is all about, I kind of needed some sort of anchor, at least at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't know that there was an alternative way that you, like when I was 14 and I really decided to spend a lot of time just engrossed in music and the guitar and then the piano, that seemed to be the only way at the time. And so I can understand why it varies from person to person. And, you know, I'm glad that's what called me, even though, you know, I guess it is, and I have no problem like acknowledging this. It is kind of one step removed, even though, you know, it does bring you that understanding.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, Zen, your music influences your Zen practice, and your Zen practice influences your music.
Sure.
When I started with my teacher, I was 29. After I left the convent, I was kind of like, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. You know, it's kind of like something broke in me. And I had been super rigid about Catholicism, so I probably needed a little bit of loosening up. Mm-hmm. And so everything kind of broke, and I just did everything I wasn't supposed to do, you know, I was ever told not to do. And one of the things, though, that I always had wanted to do was to study dance. And so I started studying dance right after I left the convent. And I studied all the way through my 20s. And when I was 29, the dance, which was probably was my very first experience that I remember of a samadhi experience, you know, the experience of being one. Mm-hmm. And you probably experienced this in your music. Most anybody that has an artistic endeavor experiences that sometime, you know, where suddenly you're just doing the music or the music is doing you or something. And that's what happened. I noticed it specifically in one dance class, and it comes right after you think you can't go on, and somehow your teacher pushes you and says, do it again. And all of a sudden you're danced by everything else, you know? So having had that samadhi experience, I expressed it to my teacher, and I said, is that samadhi? And he said, yes. And I said, well, if you can experience it through dance or through the arts, through music or through painting, then why do zazen? And he said, because when you experience it through a particular medium like music or dance or some other form of art, he said, he didn't say it in this way, but this is the way I say it, that zazen is generic, that you can apply what you learn from zazen to anything you do. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think that music or dance or something is the only way that you can experience that, it limits you in the rest of your life. And I know that dancers do get into that where they think they can only experience that through dance, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense to me. You know, I mean, what I learned from dance was to get beyond my resistance. And that helped me in when I got into Zazen practice. But I'd say that Zazen practice informed my dance, has informed my dance much more than dance has informed my Zazen practice. Although when I was ordained, I didn't understand the ceremony. And my teacher didn't explain it to me much beforehand. And so I was very nervous about doing things, the forms right. And then I thought, oh, I'll just choreograph it, you know? So in that way, you know, it was, and I choreograph whenever I make a schedule for a retreat, I always try to think of the flow of it, you know? So they really work together. And I think of dance as something much deeper. There's always movement going on in life, you know? So how do we move with it rather than I want it this way? You know what I mean? So music, I studied a lot of music in my life. I studied piano for about 7 years when I was young. And I also played the guitar for a while, though I never got very good. And I played the shakuhachi for a while, though I never got very good. But I've been writing, trying to write a musical of the life of the Buddha.
Oh.
But my musical abilities are not good enough to compose music. So I'm a little bit limited there. I did find some music of a composer that I kind of like. I used to teach dance and theater. I studied theater in college. And I used to teach at an elementary Montessori school. And so I found some music of a guy that wrote music that I liked a lot, that I used a lot in my classes. And so I asked him if I could use his music and just write some words to it. But so far I haven't gotten very far. I've only gotten 2 songs written. Anyway, that's how I see it. And I mean, there are many, many ways to spirituality, and certainly my dance, my study of dance was a spiritual practice for me always. Because body and mind are not separate, you know? But when it came to the performance part of it, that's when I thought, okay, where I want to put my energy is into Zen practice. And I've done the Full Lotus since I started, and that's a very, very body thing. So that's kind of my dance.
The Full Lotus.
Are you Googling the Full Lotus?
Yes, I'm not sure.
I can show you.
Oh, it's what?
It's a cross-legged position.
Uh-huh.
Put your feet up on your thighs.
Okay.
And it's according to yoga, it's a yogic position. According to yoga, it's have you done yoga?
Yes, yes.
So you know what an asana is?
I do, yep.
So they say that it's a complete asana except for the side to side. So the way my teacher taught us when we started sitting in the cross-legged position, and the Full Lotus is very stable. How old are you?
I'm 27.
You should learn how to do the Full Lotus if you're going to do meditation. It's really a good body-mind practice. Anyway, my teacher showed us when he did instruction that at the beginning, you should do a side-to-side thing where you drop your body as far as you can to the right with your breath. You take a breath and you drop your body first to the right and then breathe out and then breathe in, drop it to the left as far as you can. And you see how I'm letting my head go too. A lot of times people will hold their head, but you just drop it and you should feel a stretch along the side and breathe in and come up and then breathe out and then drop partway down, about halfway, and breathe in and come up and drop the other way down. Can you feel the stretch on the opposite side?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you have enough lift in your body, you will feel that stretch. If you don't have enough lift in your body, then you need to kind of cultivate that, because otherwise you're constricting your organs. And then just drop your head to your shoulder as you breathe out, breathe in, and drop your head to your other shoulder. And then what you'll probably notice, what I always notice, is that when I drop my head, I find all this tension in my neck. So then I kind of, you really need to prepare your body for sitting still. Get some of the kinks out. Otherwise, it's easy. And I don't really advocate sitting absolutely still in meditation. I don't think that it's good for your body, because if you're sitting crooked in any way, you can actually hurt your body. And you probably know that from, if you've ever done excessive yoga practice, pushed your body a little further than your body wanted to go. It can be very emotional and it can hurt your body. So the body is something that's very much emphasized in Soto Zen. It's the only thing it's the only instruction that's given, is to sit in an upright position with your chest open and deep breathing into your belly. And the reason they say to breathe into your belly, you can't really breathe into your belly, expanding your belly when you breathe in and collapsing your body when you breathe out, is because you get the full use of your lungs. And usually we don't breathe that deeply. So it's a deep breathing, taking the breath all the way down to your belly. And my teacher in Japan mentioned to me one time, he said, when you first sit down, take 5 deep breaths and let them out as slowly and quietly as you can. And then just drop into a natural breathing. And that has been so good, because it releases your body when you take those deep breaths, and particularly if you let them out slowly and quietly. And you do that, I'll show you, put your hands on your knees facing upwards,
mm-hmm.
and breathe through your mouth. So breathing in, and then breathe out as slowly and quietly as you can. And I usually do that at least 3 times at the beginning of meditation. It helps me just kind of settle. And you can also, when you're doing that, when you're doing the back and forth thing, do you sit on a cushion?
Usually, yeah.
So that lifts your body up a little bit. And so when you're rocking back and forth, make sure that you're balanced on your cushion. I actually use one that's sort of, they call them smile cushions. It's like a crescent shape. It's easier to find a stable position on there. And so just kind of finding that settling into the position. And you can even see if your body is relaxed by kind of letting it freely find the motion from their belly. So that's really important, that position of your body this is something that's emphasized in Soto Zen. And it makes it a real body-mind practice, which is one of the reasons why I got interested in Zen, because I wanted a kind of meditation. You know, my friends were all doing transcendental meditation, which is you just find any position, you know, I think the body-mind thing is a very important aspect of Zen practice, of meditation practice, because our body and mind are not separate. And one of the things I noticed when I started to dance is that a lot of emotional stuff came up from that, from all the movement of my body.
Mm-hmm.
And this full lotus position especially, but the cross-legged upright position really helps you to helps those emotional things to come up, and all those things that we've suppressed in our bodies, you know, we start to notice places where we hold. And when you release it, it brings up emotional stuff, you know. So some people don't stay with Zen meditation for very long, because it's difficult when those emotional things come up. Those are the kind of things we want to run away from. But those are the things we need to look at very squarely, in order to see where our delusion is. So once you've done that breathing, you put your tongue on the front roof of your mouth, right against your teeth, and then just close your mouth in a natural position and breathe through your nose. And I read somewhere recently that they're finding that nose breathing is the healthiest, is very healthy for you, which I thought, oh, good. That's great, because I've been doing it for the last 45 years. You know? So anyway, I also found that opening, I was very slouched when I started doing meditation, Zazen, Zen meditation. I found that the effort to kind of sit up straight and, you know, release that slouch has also opened up my breathing a lot. So that's been very helpful. There's a lot of things that are really good about the full lotus position. And that's why even I'm 76 now, and even at this age, I continue to make the effort to do the full lotus, because it's stable and it informs you where your body habits are, and it helps you to release them. But if you start at 27 is when I noticed my body started to become more more rigid, which is interesting. Young.
For me, it happened even earlier. I'm
oh,
actually,
really?
I'm on the tail end of some chronic pains, and even an infection. But my body matured very fast. That's part of why I've been searching for, you know, this kind of information and how to amass it into a practice and in my daily life, because I have wonderful, lovely, loving parents, but as far as maintaining your body and living a healthy lifestyle, I just don't think that type of education is accessible for a Westerner at first. It's hard to find.
Yeah, it's hard to find it. And I mean, I must say that being in the monastery in Japan really helped my diet, because it was a very traditional Japanese diet. We had meat too. I mean, it wasn't totally vegetarian, but you could be a vegetarian. The meat was always on the side. But it's a very healthy diet. It's a macrobiotic diet, basically. And I felt so good when I was there. And I was worried, because I didn't know how I would do with Japanese food. When I came back, that's what I've introduced at our temple. And some people don't like it because it's kind of strange. But and what I've introduced also is based somewhat on Chinese medicine. I worked with a Chinese doctor that of Chinese medicine, that her specialty was food for healing. And I think that's a very important, and I certainly, it was a learning curve for me. I just got a low battery notice on my computer, and I can't, if I plug it in, it doesn't work anymore. It only works if I've closed it. And I also have to leave at 1 o'clock. So
okay. I have a class.
We can meet again if you want to.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
Yeah, this has been really eye-opening, just to understand more about Soto Zen. And, I understand principles of Zen on a pretty basic level. I'm not as familiar with all of the details of the literature and terminology. So I think having some experiential knowledge, it's a good time for me to start understanding the studies now and to be able to integrate that. So I really appreciate your time, Tejo.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you. You know, I was kind of intrigued by your music interest, because a few years ago, I realized that I didn't have enough music in my life. There's not a lot of musicality in Soto Zen. It's a very different kind of like chanting in the Japanese tradition. The way they taught me to chant is to just keep breathing until a sound came out, breathing from my belly, until a sound came out. And it's pretty interesting, an interesting way to chant, but I miss the music. And so I keep trying to find a piano to play. When I go to my brother's house, I take all my music along by the piano. And I just need a little bit more music in my life. I miss that a lot. So that kind of interested me about talking with you, that you have this love of music.
Yeah, well, it's it definitely is one of the biggest parts of my life. Helps keep me buoyant and
yes, that's important. It's a good combination. I mean, dance is also a good combination with Zen, you know, because it's a body awareness thing. So yeah, music is, it's hard to describe how it affects you, but it's a whole, it is a body mind thing, really. I feel music in my body.
Oh yeah, it's, yeah, it's, I mean,
I'm down to 3%, so I think I gotta go.
Okay. No worries. Well,
get in touch with me.
What's that?
Get in touch and we'll make another time to talk.
Sure. Sounds
okay.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.